Welcome to Headlines. This is David Lichtenstein. This week we have a wonderful program. We have Harav Yosef Fleischman, who is the Av Beis Din of Nesivos Chaim. He's the Rosh Kol of the Choshen Mishpat, Kol Heichal Yosef, and the Institute for Dayanim. It's, I believe, the largest institute for Dayanim in the world. 170 Dayanim are learning Choshen Mishpat. And he will be speaking about Genevas Das, Genevas Akum, Zelos Akum, Chilul Hashem, government programs, etc. And we will, after that, we will have the president of the Aguda, Harav Chaim David Zwiebel. He will be speaking about government getting involved in schools, which is something that the Haredi community in Brooklyn is very concerned about now. Before we go to our guests, I want to remind you that on our website, after every program, we now have the Mara Makaimis in a link. So if you want to load them down, see the sightings, the tshuvas, et cetera, you can just pull them down right off the website. Our app has also been updated. Headlines Radio Show has also been updated, where you can now move around within any particular program. You can go from the beginning to the end to the middle by sliding your finger. And as always, I want to remind you that if you enjoy this program, or if you don't enjoy this program and you have issues with it, you can buy Headlines 2, which is the bestseller for OU. It has many of our programs, and you can actually take it, write comments. Look, one thing I guarantee you, you will find it interesting. Before we begin, I would like to talk about, I got a lot of calls about our guest last week, Rav Aaron Kotler. He was speaking about what was going on in Lakewood. And I can relate to it. I learned in Lakewood for a number of years. And I remember when I had to leave yeshiva, I was getting my in-laws who were wonderful, incredibly wealthy people. They were the most wealthy, wealthy people. Unfortunately, one thing they didn't have was any money. They were rich in Maisim Tovim, Yerushamayim, and knowledge and Midas. So I got $100 a week from them. And I got $100 a week from my parents. My father was a Zohar and Lavach, and my mother, my father was a Rav. And I remember a few years after we were married, we had our second child, and we couldn't make ends meet. And I said to my wife, I'm going to go to work. You know, it's like I got a call from the Mashkiach, the Mirror Mashkiach in Eretz Yisrael, called Apoirish Mena Toiru, Kipoirish Mena Chaim. And I started being ma'ayin in it. And, you know, I want to share a thought with you. It says in Parshas Korach, Moshe says to Korach, Rav Lachem B'nei Levi, enough, you have enough, he says to Korach. So the Gemara says, he said Rav Lachem B'nei Levi, so he was nispasa by the Rabbeinu Shalom, Rav Lacha al Toysev Dabarimi. When he's trying to go to Eretz Yisrael, the Rabbeinu Shalom says to him, it's enough. He was nispasa by Rav Lacha al Toysev, which seems like a play on words. He said to them, Rav Lacha, so he was punished with Rav Lacha. And I think the understanding is different. Moshe wanted to go into Eretz Yisrael. Why did he want to go in? Moshe Rei Mehemna, he brought down the Torah. He took them out of Shibud Mitzrayim. He took them from diaspora. He took them 40 years across the Midbar. What's the culmination? To see the end of the dream. The Gemara says he wasn't Chilechel Mipuri. He wanted to bring them into Eretz Yisrael, see the end of his dream. He wanted to be able to do Mekayim, the Tariyak Mitzvahs, Kitikunai. This was everything. He stood at the entrance of the promised land. He looked in. This was everything he wanted. And what happened? Hashem said, Rav Lach, enough. What is he telling Moshe? He's saying, Moshe, look, I know you want to do this, and without you don't feel fulfilled. And I'm telling you, Moshe Rabbeinu, you did the job that you were supposed to do. It may not be the job you want to do. You want to do more, but I'm telling you, you're doing what you were supposed to do. Rav Lach, it's enough. You have enough ruchnius. And when he says to Bnei Levi, what did he tell the Mavlach of Bnei Levi? What did he want to say? Koyrech? He was, I want to be the leader. I would like to be the Rosh Hashiva, the Gadol Hador. I'm not satisfied being Pikeach and Bnei Levi exalted. I want to be more. And what does Moshe say? That's your job. Everybody has their tafkid. This was your tafkid, Moshe tells him. So it says he was Nespaser, Rav Lachal Taisiv Dabrib. You can't go into Eretz Yisrael. The Malbim says, Surah is always Lashon Tov. Kol Mavaser, Allah Harim. Right? It's always a good... What's he saying? He's saying you finished your job properly. You want more? There's a concept in Kiddusha also of Sameach B'chalkai. And, you know, I saw a beautiful pshat It says, Yismach Moshe b'matnas chalkei. Moshe, be sameach b'matnas chalkei. Be sameach b'chalkei. Like, what does that mean? Because Moshe didn't finish his mission. And what's the, Yismach Moshe b'matnas chalkei, ki eved neman karas alai. You were an eved neman. You did what you were supposed to do. Maybe you dreamt for more. It's good to dream. But you were the eved neman. You accepted your position and your mission. And that's really what he told Adas Kairach too. There is a concept in Kedusha. What does Shimon Hamsuni say? Kishem shekibalti schar al hadrisha, kach ekabal schar al aprisha. The same schar that you get for trying, for dreaming, the same schar you get for the prisha too. So as we believe we're Avdei Hashem, my purpose wasn't meant to be a Rosh Hashiva, obviously. I did not have the financial opportunity to learn in Kol that many years. I did not. With my in-laws, my parents are both very wealthy, but they had no money. They're wealthy in spirituality and in ruchnius, etc. So what is the message? There is a concept of Sameach B'chalkai by ruchnius too. And I'll bring you a proof, and then we'll go to our guests. Chafetz Chaim says that one time, Chaim V'lajina, was learning Tana de Be'elio. Seems Litvish also learned Tana de Be'elio. And it says in Tana de Be'elio that one of the attributes of Kav Yachal, of the Rabbi Nisholm, or an attribute of God, is that he's Sameach B'chalkai. So he ran into the Gra, his great Rebbe, the Vilna Gaon, and he said, Sameach B'chalkai, God owns everything. What does it mean, he's Sameach B'chalkai? So the Gra said to him, it says, Yaakov Chevel Nachlasai. They're all the Umay Sa'ilam. He chose a tiny nation that maybe sometimes isn't so worthy. We've seen terrible things sometimes that people do. So he said, the Rebbeinu Shalom is Sameach B'chalkai B'Klal Yisrael. So the Chafetz Chaim says, you see that Sameach B'chalkai is in Ruchnius too, but Kav Yachal, it's only Ruchnius. I say to people who are mourning and they say, you know, how am I going to survive and how will I stay in learning if I can't do this? Well, you know what? We have to be Sameach. Sometimes our job was not to be to be like Moshe, not to go into the promised land, or to be like the par, the one that was the Scottish Al Yadeh by leaving. Sameach B'chalke refers to children too. So, his son, he didn't get into the yeshiva, or he has no interest in going to the yeshiva that you want him to. Your daughter, the school. Do we have to be Sameach B'chalke maybe with Dvarim Ruchniyim when it refers to our children too? That's not what they were cut out to do. It's the fact that even Moshe had to be Yismach Moshe b'matnas chalkai, ki eved neman karasalai. He did the best that he could. He did everything that he was supposed to do, that he was cut out to do. Does that refer to maybe our children as well?
So just something to think about. So let's go to our fabulous guest. They say he is the preeminent expert in Choshen Mishpat. Perhaps the preeminent expert in Choshen Mishpat in Eretz Yisrael, maybe the world, Avin Rabbi Yosef Fleischman. We have the honor of having with us on the phone from Yerushalayim, Rabbi Yosef Fleischman, who's the Av Bezdin of Bezdin Asivas Chaim. He's also the Rosh Kol Choshen Mishpat Heichal Yosef, and he's also the head of the Institute for Dayanim, where they have 170 people training for Dayanis. Welcome, Rabbi Fleischman.
Thank you very much. How are you?
Rav Fleischman, I learned in yeshiva for many years, and then I went out to work. And unfortunately, I never had a primer on Choshen Mishpat, on dealing in the marketplace, etc. Things such as, you know, Gezel Akum, Gnevas Akum, whether there's Einor Bayakum, whether there's a concept of Gnevas Das, the concept of Chil Hashem, Mata Akum. Could you give me, for my own personal uses, a little bit of a primer, and maybe the audience, whoever feels that they can listen in, can share whatever you teach me, you could share with them as well.
Okay. The first thing that you mentioned was about stealing from a guy. So stealing from a guy is a Gemara in Bava Kama and Daf Kuf Yud Gimel Amud Aleph. The Gemara says, "Amar Rab Shimon, Dava Zed Dorish Rabbi Akiva Kishaba Mizpirin, Minayin Vegezel Kanani Shu Asa." From where do you learn that Gezel Kanani is Asa? Tamaloma Achrei Nimka Geula Tielo. That when a person, someone is sold as an Eved, to a Jew is sold as an eved to a goy. So the Torah says, "Achrei nimkar," after he sold to the goy, "geula tielo," the goy has to allow him to be redeemed. The Gemara says two things. Gemara says, "Shloim shechena v'yetze," which Rashi says means that Bezdin can't take him away from the goy. And the Gemara says, "Yochol yigum olav tamadom v'chishav im koneu yedaktik im koneu." The Tosfos says what it means is, that we know that when someone is sold as an eved, so the din is that one figures out how many years he sold for and the price that he was sold for, and then you figure out how many years are left. That's the proper price to pay someone in order to redeem the eved. And so the Gemara says that a person might think that maybe you could, with a guy, you could be lenient and you could trick him and pay him a little bit less. So that's what the Gemara calls yiglum olav. So the Gemara says, no, we learn out from a pasuk, it says, v'chishav im koneu, yidaktik im koneu, that you have to be fair with the guy, and you have to pay the exact amount that you know, if, for example, he was sold for 10 years for $1,000, and he worked for 1 year, so then you take off 10%. And that's all. And all the rest you have to give back, because that's learned out from the pasuk of v'chishav im koneu, which seems to indicate, as Gemara is learning out from a pasuk, and it would seem to indicate that it's a din d'oraisa, and a lot of Rishonim learn that it's an issa d'oraisa, and that also seems to be the opinion of the Shulchan Aruch. The Shulchan Aruch says in Simen Shin Mem Ches Sif Beis, and similarly in Shin Nun Tes, the Shulchan Aruch quotes the Rambam. Rambam says, "Kol agonev afilu shava puta over al lav de lo sigdovu." If someone steals even a shava puta, he's over on the lav of lo sigdovu. The chayv l'shalim, and the Rambam continues, "Echad agonev momen yisrael or agonev momen shagoyim." Doesn't make a difference if he's stealing from money of a Jew or money of a goy. And the Rambam seems to include both of them. He said that there was lo sigdovu, and then he says that it doesn't make any difference if you're stealing momen of Yisrael or gonev momen shogoy.
What about gnevas das akum?
So gnevas das akum is a beferish gemara. The gemara in Chulin daf tzadi dalet of it alf. The gemara says that it says the Omer Shmuel. The example the Gemara is talking about over there is when a person is selling a piece of meat to a guy, and the guy gets the impression that you've removed the gir anasha from there, that you made the meat as kosher as a Jew would have it, and you're then giving it to the guy. And so the Gemara says that it's us to give him the impression that you made the meat kosher when you didn't. And the reason why is because Shmuel says that it's us a lignov dasa bias afilu dasa shalav kuchavim.
This is also a deraisa, I take it.
You're asking really a double question. There's first of all, because there are some machlokas. One machlokas is whether gneivas das bichlal, even by a Jew, is the raisa d'rabbanan. That's not, you know, there's no beferish gemara about it. So it's discussed by Rishonim. One Rishon that discusses it, and probably the basis of one school of thought, is the Ireim. The Ireim in Simon Kufchav Dalet says, "Goniv das abiyas b'midi d'momen, hava b'chlal momen," that when you're goniv das abiyas in something related to money, we'll discuss that in a minute, it's considered to be momen, v'ova alo signovu, that you're over on lo signovu, and he brings the Tosefta then in Bava Kama, that it says that he has gifts. Gimel ganavim heim, the gifts that we have, the shiva ganavim heim, and it says, "Rishon shebekulim," the worst of the ganavim, is goniv das abiyas. And the reason why goniv das abiyas is even worse than momen is, he says, because that's something which is affecting a person's mental attitude, and that's worse than stealing his money. He brings that you find by Avshalom that it says that he stole, it is going to leave Oviv, leave Bezdin, leave Kol Yisrael, and because of that, the Gemara is Gemara Sota, and that's Pesach. Gemara says, because of that, he got stabbed three times because he three times was going to. And he goes on, and he says that the pasuk is going both by Jews and both by goyim. The pasuk lo signovu is in the beginning of Pasuk's Kedoshim, and the pasuk goes like this: it says lo signovu, lo sechachashu, lo sechaku ish bamiso. So the end of the pasuk says ish bamiso, which implies that it's, the Gemara says amiso is a Jew. So says the Sefer Yireim that no, if you will be a Bal Koreh, so it says lo tignovu, and then it's nasnachta on the lo tignovu, and lo sechachashu lo shakri ish bamiso. So it says the Sefer Yireim that the word ish bamiso only goes on sechachashu lo shakri, but on lo tignovu the word ish bamiso does not apply. And says sorry, tam nigun mapsiko umetzin psuke tam. In the Gemara says in the Dorm that Gemara says that Ezra brought down psuke tam, and you see from there that the din of that the word ish bamiso does not refer to lo signovu. And since lo signovu, according to the safety reim, lo signovu includes gnevas das, so therefore he says that gnevas das, even from a goy, is a deraisa.
What about dina de malchusa dina? Is that also an issa?
Dina de malchusa dina for sure is a din. The Gemara says in a few places, the Gemara, for example, in the Dorm, the Gemara says, no din de mochsa, that if a mochis comes around and wants to evaluate your property in order to decide how much taxes to pay, so you can deny that there are certain things. You can say, this is not mine, that's not mine, and you're even allowed to make a nedir. The Gemara asks the question, how can you do such a thing? Shmuel said,
dina de malchusa
dina. So Gemara says, it says a certain kind of mochis who is not
illegitimate, a robber, a thief.
Yeah, the Gemara says either he's a mochis or omed meilav, and he's not appointed by the government, he just did, or he's a mochis shein lo kitzbi, he decides, his friends he charges a little bit, and there's his not such good friends he charges more, his enemies charge a lot. So such a person, you're allowed to be nodun mochsim. But if not, then there's a din of dina de machusa dina. And there's even a question.
And I believe Avni Maluam says it's a daraisa, am I correct?
That's correct, but that's also a machlokas. That's very good. There's a Beis Shmuel in the beginning of Simen Chaf Ches in Evan Ezer. So the Beis Shmuel says that it talks about a different din in the Machus that they had, the Goyim, and as we know, that Yish and Shinah Rishis is Kodesh. So if a person is Mekadosh and Isha with Gezel, so then, and it's Acha Yish, so it says that he can be Mekadosh with the Gezel because there was Yish by the Baal, and the Shinah Rishis when he gives the Tabas to the Isha, and so therefore Yekoneh was Yish and Shinah Rishis. Ask the Beis Shmuel that what do we do nowadays that the Goyim say that you can't be Koneh with Yish and Shinah Rishis even then. So Beis Shmuel gives he says a lashon that since that the Torah it's good anyway. Says Bizman Hazeh Machmas Din Machuso, so you should have to give it back. And so he says, but he says that in Kol Mokom that's going to be okay because Midaraisa Konsa Chayfetz, that Midaraisa is good Kedushin, so even though there's Din de Machusa Dina, but at least on the level of a Daraisa, it's okay. And that jumps Avni Milum on the base wall, and he says that's not true because Din de Machusa Dina is also Daraisa. So you see that there's a difference, and they're not the only people. There are a lot of people who argue whether Din de Machusa Dina is a Daraisa Durabonin. But it's correct what you said.
Rabbi Fleischman, if somebody's over, Gzela Sakram, Gnevasa Sakram, is there any difference between doing that and eating a Big Mac at McDonald's?
Well, it's difficult to, I mean, it says at the Marshal that by mitzvahs aseh, the Torah doesn't tell you the schar, because otherwise people are going to all want to do certain mitzvahs aseh. So we don't know exactly, Your view is correct. In other words, a person should know that the same Kodesh Baruch who gave us an issa to eat treif also said that one can't be all those people that hold that Gezel Akum is a deraisa and Gneivas Das of Akum is a deraisa. So it's the same, this is a deraisa and that's a deraisa. And on top of it, there's also a secondary problem, which you may not have if you eat a Big Mac in your house, that we see that there's an Indian of Chil Hashem, that Chil Hashem can be on top of it. In other words, that if you do something which can cause a Chil Hashem, so that's an additional issa to it.
Let me ask you another question. The Shulchan Aruch in Hilchos Eidus says that that one of the psuli Eidus is hanoitel tzedakim and akum. Do you think
right.
that somebody who is hanoitel tzedakim and akum through using programs, or certainly if it's done illegally, would have this problem of the psuli Eidus that Mechaba brings in Simon Lama Dalad, And the Rishonim say it's all Chil Hashem, the Chamas, etc.,
right,
which certainly have a Chil Hashem. Would you think that
it's much better.
I would think so,
but that would be included in that, because over there it says the reason why is because of an element of Chil Hashem, and because it looks as if we need Goyim's money to support our Torah, and so if that is in our eyes, a much more minor Chil Hashem than a Chil Hashem, of major proportions, which everyone thinks is, wrong. So, especially the Inyan of Chil Hashem, the Gemara says, Inyan of Chil Hashem is people's impression. Right? The Gemara says that the Inyan of Chil Hashem is that a person through his actions should cause Hashem's name to be loved. People should say that this person, he learned Torah and he acts so nice with the Brias, so I want my son also to learn Torah. And someone who causes Hashem's name to be not loved by the Brias, that's what's a Chil Hashem, because you're causing people to not want to fulfill mitzvahs, not want to learn Torah. So therefore,
This would be more chamer. Now, I had one of my callers say that, signing illegally or lying on an application of for grants has a din of mate akum and it's not gnevas akum. And I have two questions. First of all, is that really mate akum? Like if somebody passes a bad check, is that called mate akum or is that called gnevas akum?
I mean, first of all, who said that you can be mata and akum? That's number one. Saying before that gnevas das of a goy is asur, so then you can't be mata goy either, right? What is mata?
Well, there's two days in the Ramah where the mata akum is asur, right? So according to the Tzad in the Ramah, that mata akum is asur, would passing a bad check have a din of mata akum or gnevas akum? Or signing document on the perjury.
If you're getting money,
in fact, is that mata akam or is that gnevas akam?
Well, if you then take money from them, that would become gnevas akam, because you're getting money out of them. Like the shach brings over there what you're talking about. It says the yesh omen the asalatoso, and he says an elam kain. And he brings then this same mashal, and he says, "Because of Shem, the mikom akom yomer liYisrael, rei shal cheshbon chanisabech." The gam of course alba ena muta, kishchayv the shalom o derech meches o derech chov. The mashal differentiates over there whether a person does it. If you get the goods from the guy and then you have to pay him back, so he says that could fall into the category of tosakum. However, if you're going to fool him in order to get something from him, says the mashal, that that's also because that's not called toras akum, because you're getting something from the goy, and that's why he says the derech mekachet zonim. Also, in the shach there agrees with the mashal. I think also people should be aware there's a very well known, maybe the best known Be'er HaGolah. People usually ignore the Be'er HaGolah. So the Be'er HaGolah then it says it two places, but referring to the same thing.
Shin Mem Ches Beis, right?
In yeah. Shin Mem Ches Nabez. Hey, so he says there that he's seen a lot of people that Shereisi Rabim Godlu Veshirim in Tos Shitu Akum, like you say, that they cause Goyim to make mistakes. Lo Itzlichu Yodim Nechseim L'Timoyon Lo Nich Achreim Brocha, didn't leave anything over. Kamo Shkos L'Sefer Chasidim Rab Mashikitra Hashem Nechziru Toyas Akum B'Dav Achoshev Godlu Veshiru V'Itzlichu V'Nichu Yisum L'Olodeim. So he says that whatever it is, but the ultimate purpose of everyone is people want to have money. So he's telling you that for good advice, if you really want to have money, so honesty is the best policy. If you're honest, so you'll have more money. And there's a famous story, I don't know if it's true or not, but there's a famous story of someone who was a wealthy firm philanthropist, and they say a story that he found, made renovations on his house. He found money there under the carpet, and they asked Reb Moshe what he should do, and Reb Moshe told him that he should, and the guy didn't know anything about it. The guy sold him the house without knowing it, being aware that there was money there, and yet Reb Moshe said he should give it back and it'll become wealthy, and kachaya, that's what they say. So people can be encouraged that it's better to be honest.
Let me ask you another question. If somebody steals from the government, right, by lying on one of these forms, So is that Gnevas Akam or Gnevas Yisrael? And what do I mean to say? There are certainly many, many people who pay taxes who are from a Yidin, Erlach Yidin, or not from, but the Yidin, right? That there's an Issa Gnevas of Midarais Lakala Deis, right? And they are also partners in this kiss. They pay millions and millions and millions, hundreds of to taxes. So it's a shutfis that it's 98% or 90% Gayim and 10% Yidin. Somebody steals. Is he either Gnevas Akam or Gnevas Yisrael also?
I mean, I agree with you.
You steal from a partnership that's 10%. That's 10% Yidin. Are you either both Gnevas Yisrael and Gnevas Akam, or are you either just Gnevas Akam?
Yeah, normally you say that the in those, that's it's the only thing that could happen is if there were too few Jews. So then maybe it'll become pocket b'shal puta. But if you steal, you know, significant amounts or the significant amount of Jews, it's correct. That's what I think. Because they and post can say like that, that taxes nowadays are not, besides the fact that there's dina de machusa dina and other things involved, but taxes nowadays are not what taxes were in the time of the Gemara and the Rishonim. In those days, the money went basically to the king, and the king did with it what he wanted. Nowadays, taxes are basically being given to a fund, the treasury, and the treasury really is, then it's split up into the various things as is decided by the president and Congress, and then so the money really is the people's money, and you can't steal, just like you can't steal from a corporation. The corporation is the same thing. It has lots and lots of stockholders, and every stockholder is really an owner of a partial owner of the corporation. One doesn't steal from a company and say that, you know, you can steal a little bit, because most of the owners are goyim. At least I didn't hear that.
Right. So what I take away from this is that, well, let me say, make a summary, that to take to lie in one of these programs or to taxes, etc. It's a shy. It's Gnevas Akam. It's Gnevas Yisrael. It's Gnevas Das. Dina de Malchusa Chil Hashem. And you said, the makam where there's no chil Hashem, you would not say that the person is pasul edus, and they would have to do the kedushin over, because you say there's kamasibis, there's other edim by the thing, etc. Or maybe you say he could have a din of an ayma muta, and you would say the din of ayma muta. And okay, we'll come back to that. And what you said, but he's over four or five derises, including possibly the din of including chil Hashem, which is very chamar, and also could be Gnevas Yisrael. So if I'm Chayshish, the Chassu Shalom, I was over in any of this, what type of tshuva should I do?
In general, for example, it says by Chil Hashem, the Gemara in Yuma says that the Dalet Chulukah Kapor, people know the Gemara, at the end of Yuma, so the Gemara says that Matthias Ben Chersh in Rome, and he dashed that Arba Chulukah Kapor, and the worst one there, the Gemara says, is Chil Hashem, because all the other, some things a person can do tshuva on the spot, some things a person can do tshuva and have Yisurim, and it says, Bechil Hashem, it says, the Gemara brings a pasuk in Yeshaya, the Gemara says, Abba Mishi Yesh B'yodah Chil Hashem B'yodah, Ein Lo Koach B'tshuva Litlos Lo Yom HaKulim L'chape, Lo Yisurim L'marek, El HaKulim told him, Nisim Marekes Shalem, V'nigla Bo'ozni Hashem Tzvokas, M'chuba Avon Azel Lechem, Ad Temusin. So the Gemara seems to say there's nothing to do except die. However, it says that, and I think the Chofetz Chaim also brings, the Rabbeinu Bechai brings in the Kara Kemach, that the way to do tshuva, we know everything is by doing the opposite. So he says there that it brings from pasuk that it says, pasuk says in Emor, it says, Lo sechalu Hashem kodshi, v'negdashti b'soch b'nei Yisrael. So he says that the way to be mechaper for Chil Hashem is by making Kiddush Hashem. Because a person should then do things which are Kiddush Hashem, you know, act in an exemplary manner, and as much as a person can, and by doing Kiddush Hashem, so a person, you know, can undo the Chil Hashem that he did, which is certainly very advisable, because you see what kind of punishment the person gets for Chil Hashem. So a person should go out of his way to make a Kiddush Hashem, and by Gezel, so he should return it. If the Gezel, there's an interesting shaila whether by Gezel Akum there's a din. We know by Jews there's halacha to make Hashavas Gezelu. It's a pasuk in Chumash, but by Goyim there's a machlokus whether there's a din of being meshiv, and there's a tshuva. And one of the people, later people, Moshe discusses, someone asked him, a shayla, person was about tshuva, and one of the things that he did was he stole from all kinds of things. And so he stole from his parents, he stole from the public, and he also stole from Goyim. So Moshe told him that what's be'en, you certainly should give back. Says it's tshuva in Choshen Mishpat Chelik Al Simen Peches. So he says, and he also stole from the telephone company, the subway, and everything. He says, "Vare tzorach tshuva azeh uizor shelo ases od." Bechapetzin should be end sheyesh lema dayin tzorach lohoshit. That for sure you have to give back whatever is be'en. He says it's a tosefta and a Rambam, but. And if in Einam Ben, the owner is Mesupkani, Vyashdin Tashlum, and Vroy Lahachmi. He says he should give it back. And so whatever you can do. And he brings this Nesivus, if Nesivus wants to say that maybe there's no din of a Heshad as Exela. But it also doesn't become Shalom. The Nesivus says that even if you say, whatever you say about Gezel Akum, but it's not yours.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Fleischman. It's been a big honor and a covet to have you on with us.
Thank you.
We have the honor of having with us on the phone from New York City the Executive Vice President of the Agudas Yisrael of America, the well-known Rav Chaim David Zwiebel. Welcome, Rav Zwiebel.
Thank you very much, David. I appreciate your inviting me on.
Now, I just want to restate what we said before. There is no President of the Agudas Yisrael of America. So I guess as Executive Vice President of the Agudas Yisrael, you're as close to the President of a title as they have. Is that correct?
Well, the Novominska Rebbe Shlita is Rosh Agudas Yisrael, so I'm not sure. I certainly won't compete with his proximity to whatever it is that stands at the helm and the top of the organization. He's there, and he's that. And Baruch Hashem, it's my schus to be the executive head of the organization and to help carry out the directives of the Novominska Rebbe and other members of the Moetz Gedolia Torah.
Okay, so let's talk about something that you've spoken about on a number of occasions, which is the danger of government involvement in our school system, and you've spoken about it on a number of occasions. Hmm. Could you give us a little context of what this is?
Sure. In general, abstract principle, what ought to be essential for the success of our yeshiva community is the independence of the yeshiva community, the ability of people who are expert in the area of chinuch to establish a system of chinuch, to determine what should be learned by our children and when it should be learned, what things should not be learned, what values of the broader secular society that may be taught in the public schools are appropriate for teaching in our schools and which are not appropriate for teaching in our schools. Preserving the independence of our yeshivas has to be considered absolutely at the top of any agenda in advocacy on behalf of the yeshiva community. And for many, many years, this has been largely not a problem, but in recent years it has become more of an issue and is now actually something which is very much in the crosshairs of people who are trying to make our yeshivas more like the public schools and make sure that certain courses are taught and certain attitudes are taught. So we're facing a moment here in the United States and frankly in many places around the world where the independence of the yeshiva community and the yeshivas themselves is under scrutiny, under attack, and something I think which represents a major danger for Klal Yisrael today.
And what precipitated this?
Well, I'll talk about what's happening here in New York, the reason that this has become a hot issue, so to say, here in New York. It's because about a year and a half or two ago, I forget precisely when it was, a complaint was filed with the New York City Department of Education. And the essence of the complaint was that certain schools, and I believe that they named 39 different schools, are not teaching their students the courses that the students require in order to be able to be productive members of society. They're not compliant with the New York State law that says that instruction in non-public schools should be substantially equivalent to that which is provided in the public schools. And the complainants, many of them who had gone through the yeshiva system, said that the yeshivas did not prepare them properly, did not comply with the law, and that the government had failed, had been derelict in its duty to make sure that the schools were in fact providing the kind of education which is substantially equivalent to that afforded in the public schools. So this became a formal complaint that was filed with the New York City Department of Education. The Department of Education has been conducting an investigation. It has announced that it will be issuing a report this summer on the outcome of its investigation. I know that the yeshivas have been working together. The 39 named schools in this complaint have been working together. They have formed an entity called PEARLS to represent their interests and to focus on the overall issue. This is very much a live matter. It's also graduated from the New York City Department of Education to the New York State Education Department and the New York State Board of Regents. There have been elements of this conversation also that have taken place in New Jersey, where there has been some focus on the number of hours that are devoted to Limudei Chol in yeshivas, for example, in the Lakewood community, the sufficiency of the Limudei Chol. So this is an issue which is very much al haperek, as we would say. It's on the current agenda. There have been bills introduced in the state legislature that would address this concern. As a matter of fact, there's one in New York, which would strengthen this concept of the requirement that non-public schools like yeshivas provide education that is substantially equivalent to that which is provided in the public schools. And they speak about a non-public school must provide students with instruction that is similar in rigor, allotted time, and subject to that which is provided in the public schools. And if the non-public schools don't do all that, they don't have 5 hours a day in Limudei Chol as the public schools do and are required to do, then they can be subject to all kinds of different penalties, including withdrawal of funding, and even the bill says that the Commissioner of Education in New York State may permanently revoke the non-public school's registration, or if not registered, prohibit the school from operating, close down the school. So there is legislation of this nature pending in Albany, which obviously, if it gets enacted, would create the potential for a tremendous earthquake in our community. Because that would theoretically apply not only to the 39 schools that have been identified in this particular complaint and are subject to the current investigation in New York City, but it would apply virtually across the board to the entire yeshiva community.
Rabbi Zubel, you're taking like sort of like the disaster case scenario, mm-hmm. where they come in and they say, you know, you need 5 hours a day, which is basically if you start at 9, 10, 11, 12, 1, 2, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock you can start, and that's clearly not acceptable. We understand the – now let's look at the other side of the argument. Mm-hmm. You know, we had a Chassidish family just in our house last Shabbos. My wife did a weekend for an organization a charitable organization, and there was a boy, he's in fifth grade, a Chassidish boy, and I asked him, right? And I try to like make how much is 10 times 10? And he looks at his mother and he says 80. He says we don't learn that type of math in fifth grade. I said okay. I just like try to give things that are so easy. I say I'm trying to make friends with the kid. I said mm-hmm. how do you spell house?
Mm-hmm.
And his mother looks at me. She says oh, that's to advance. They don't teach that. Now, I Googled this topic, and I saw that the New York Times had an article where there was a fellow who graduated, I don't remember what type of yeshiva, I'm assuming a Chassidish yeshiva. And he said afterwards he was looking, he had to go to further education to get a job, and he said he was 10 years behind everybody. He didn't know what a molecule was. He didn't know the very basics. Now, given that, on one hand, we don't want the government intruding and telling us how much time, you know, we want to start our day, like, you know, like I did, I went to all the good yeshivas, and you start with, you know, davening, gemarashi, taisfis, you learn chumash, you learn musa, you learn halacha, and then at 3 or 4 o'clock they started English. But like Yeshiva Philadelphia, which is led by the God Lader, Shmuel Kamenetsky, has a very rigorous, I mean, look, basically, Bill, you're an attorney. Think of how empowered it allowed you to be. So on one hand, we understand the value of education, but on the other hand, we don't want government intrusion. Now, it seems that many yeshivas left on their own are abusive to the other extreme, where they teach minimal so that the kids don't know reading, writing, arithmetic, and absolute power that we want to give the yeshiva. We know absolute power, absolute corrupts, absolute. So how do we walk the line of if you allow yeshivas to be on their own, clearly many will fail. On the other hand, allowing government involvement is very dangerous because we believe that it all starts with Yerushalayim, with Derech Eretz Kadmah LaTorah, with, you know, Torah Tziva Lanu Moshe, and with our own hanhagas, both in Musa and in Torah. How do we walk along? We don't give the yeshiva absolute power. On the other hand, we don't allow the government to intrude. Do you recognize the conundrum?
It's an important question, and obviously, I hope obviously, I'm not advocating that our children grow up uneducated and unequipped to deal with the most basic needs of anybody who's going to be a productive member of society. If Gedolei Yisrael were to be asked the question, how does one deal with the imperative of Hanheg Bohem Minig Derech Eretz today in terms of what our children are educated, I would imagine, and certainly from everybody that I've spoken to about this, they would all say that certainly at a bare minimum, every child who goes through the yeshiva system should emerge from the yeshiva system knowing basic communication skills, reading, writing, being able to express himself, knowing computational skills, and the other things that are essential just to be productive members of society, and that's something which should be included in any educational system. And I'm not arguing against that, obviously. But you're right in pointing out that the real issue over here is to what extent do we invite government or ask government to come in and police those things and impose its own views of what might be necessary and what is important to be a well-educated person, versus allowing the community through its individual yeshivas and morei hora and morei derech and individual parents who choose which yeshiva to send their child to be the ones who help form that. I don't think that we're speaking about absolute power when we speak about the power in the yeshivas, because parents have choices. There are many, many different yeshivas, Baruch Hashem, today, and they are operated by a different menalim with a different Rosh Yeshiva or a different Morei Derech to whom they turn, and that is reflected in a fairly broad diversity of educational options that are available for even within the Hasidic world.
But Rabbi Zwiebel, let me interrupt, because you made two points. You said parents have options, and also, but how do we police bad yeshivas? In other words, when you have yeshivas that children are coming out of, and they're unequipped for life, and it's neged halacha, I mean, the halacha of chayiv adam lamed b'nai umnes, like you said, hanig ben minig derech eretz, is brought in the Shulchan Aruch. The Shulchan Aruch says on Shabbos, I think it's in either Shin Vav or Shin Zayin, you're allowed to learn teach these studies on Shabbos, that's how important it is. Secular studies, math, etc., right? So the question is, how do we police bad yeshivas? Clearly, societally, we're not equipped And I'm talking about there are many, many wonderful yeshivas. I believe you went to Tarvadas, fantastic yeshiva, Philadelphia, Mir, wonderful yeshivas. How do we police those bad yeshivas that just leave their children totally inequipped for life? And to say that the yeshiva has its own rights, I don't know if that's correct, because ultimately the idea is, you know, we societally recognize when people are unequipped, they become a burden on society. Either they, you know, become criminal. I mean, why don't we allow drug use? It's done in your house. Because ultimately we understand that what happens in your house or what happens in private ultimately becomes a burden on society. If the government is not the police bad yeshivas, how do we police bad? We're not equipped. And it's, I don't think it's that dissimilar, by the way, to a different struggle that we have in halacha now as well. We know that there are people in yeshivas, you have the concept of pedophiles. We recognize that halachically this should come in front of a Beis Din. On the other hand, we also recognize that Batei Dinim, sadly, do not have the policing powers that we would have if there was a Sanhedrin. And there are bad people in society, and they do need to be policed. How do we police the bad yeshivas?
So I have, again, two comments on that. Number one is, coming back to what I said earlier, we have the power, we as parents have the power to exercise our choice with our feet. And if we're not happy where our children are because we think that they're not being taught appropriately or with sufficient emphasis on certain types of subjects, we can take the child out of the yeshiva and put him in a different yeshiva, quote-unquote, a good yeshiva.
But Rabbi Zwiebel, well, let me just ask you, when it comes to, let me use drugs as an analogy. There are people who say we should legalize drugs because parents have a right, individuals have a right. If we want to use drugs, let's use drugs. And the answer is there are a lot of uneducated people. There are people who just have it really wrong. I mean, like I think Winston Churchill once said, if you want to understand the dangers of democracy, talk to your average voter, you know, as far as the intelligence. I mean, you have many people that are just ignorant. They're brought up in ghettos. They're brought up, you know, unenlightened, and they don't appreciate the value of an education. So to say societally, make your own decision about drugs, make your own decision about other destructive behaviors, we know that doesn't work. So why should we assume that all parents are going to do the right thing when clearly many parents don't do the right thing?
So again, the answer, that brings me to the second question, the second point that I wanted to make. You speak about good schools and bad schools. I think that we have to respect the fact that a miracle has happened here in this country, and that is the rebirth of Torah Judaism, and at a time in an era when the assumptions were that we would all fall away by the wayside, and you had great Gedalia Yisrael who established the system of yeshivas as we currently know them, which emphasizes long hours of immersion in Torah study, trying to develop not just people who are basically literate in Torah, but who are Talmidei Chachamim. And this has been one of the great miracles and the great accomplishments when the historians look back at this period of time and consider what was accomplished by a generation that was rebuilding.
Am
Saridei Charev, absolutely. One of the great success stories is the fact that we now have legions of young Bnei Tzaira, Talmidei Chachamim, with whom our Zaydis and Elta Zaydis would have taken tremendous pride back in the old country. And to be able to have done that on the Trefa Steina of America, so to say, is an enormous achievement. So the fact that students in the schools that we're talking about, that there was a decided emphasis on Limudei Kodesh, even sometimes at the expense of Limudei Chol, let's not call that bad or something which has to be rooted out and so on and so forth. There are many parents who want that for their children. They want their children to grow up to be totally immersed in Limud HaTorah. So again, I think the answer to your question is yes, it's true that some parents don't think about these things. They don't have their own values sorted out in their minds, and they just send a child to school and don't even think about it. But that's obviously, I think, the exception to the norm, and certainly it should be the exception to the norm. We should be encouraging parents v'shinantam uvanecha. It's your obligation to teach. The school is only your shliach. You have to pick your shliach, your agent, very carefully, and make sure that the shliach is one that exercises its responsibility properly and teaches your children and turns them into the types of Erlecha B'nai Torah and Talmidei Chachamim that we are, you know, we are so proud of. And now if you find that a school has been totally lax in Limudei Chol, and you recognize that's a dangerous thing and it's not good for your child, take the child out. Move the child. Now, again, so there are parents who won't do that. You know, what we ought to do is speak to the parents and encourage them to, you know, to exercise their intelligent choice and options in terms of chinuch for their children. Because
so
there
Rabbi
surely
Zwiebel,
are a lot of available options out there.
So, Rabbi Zwiebel, basically what we're advocating is absolute power to yeshivas, no oversight, no ability to criticize or bring, you know, to ask yeshivas that are derelict in their duty. Just give them absolute power. Assume that parents will do the right thing, even though many of the parents, like if you're in one of these very cloistered chassidus and you can't take your kid out of the yeshiva. If you do, they'll throw you out of the community. No oversight, absolute. Assume that cloistered parents are the intelligent and give the yeshivas absolute power and hope that society fixes it.
Right. I guess if I were in a position, if my job were to develop a policy for our secular government and I were faced with this challenge, then I would certainly want to ask myself, how does one draw the appropriate balance? Recognizing, of course, that the yeshivas and other non-public schools are independent entities. That's the reason why they're not public schools, right? They're private schools. They're independent schools, and if they have their own identity, they have a certain vision, and that they can develop a course of study for their students that reflects that vision and that brings about a result that might be a little bit different than what's produced in the public schools, while at the same time ensuring that every single student, no matter which school he attends, will emerge from the schooling process with what I described earlier as the basic skills necessary, the basic educational tools necessary to be a productive member of society. And yes, I think I probably would, as a state legislator, for example, interested in imposing in developing that policy, look for that balance of respect for the ability of the yeshiva community or other non-public school groups to establish a system of education, recognizing that the type of education that's provided in the yeshiva system does itself have enormous academic value besides whatever religious value it may have for the students. Tremendous academic value. Somebody learns Bava Kama or anything else for that matter, learns Chumash and Rashi, and you know has acquired tremendous skills in textual analysis, in rigorous thinking, in all of the different things that are really the ultimate purpose of what we're trying to accomplish with education. Recognize all those things and at the same time say, but do your children know how to communicate? Do they know how to read? Do they know how to write? Are they able to have certain basic computational skills that are necessary? And there, you know, there's a certain baseline of basics. Today, however, what we're talking about, and when we face the challenge that we've seen here in the United States and around the world, we're talking about governments coming in and being far more prescriptive as to what has to be taught in a private school. They're now talking about, there was a school in England which was shut down, actually, believe it or not, shut down because they didn't teach proper respect for people of various orientations.
But clearly, Rabbi Zwiebel, we both recognize that we're going to have cases, outlier cases, that are absurd. I mean, there was a case where a fellow broke into somebody's house in the middle of the night, and while he was robbing the house, he was injured. And some particular court, he sued the landlord because he broke a leg, and he won in a particular court. It was a Reader's Digest article. So clearly we have the absurd. But
we lawyers are good, no?
Yes, the lawyers are good. But I think to try to draw societal norms from the absurd is dangerous. And I just come back to, it's a simple question, do we advocate that we give the yeshivas absolute power? And if the answer is yes and trust society, I understand that. I personally disagree. I think everybody needs somebody overseeing them. And until we as a society could create, so what would it be? Yeah, legislate where you need reading, writing, and arithmetic, and anything that could be potentially touches on religion, such as science. You know, we talk about areas of science that are evolution. All these things could be, I would understand that. But to give an absolute free pass,
right,
to say, if you're a school, you can do whatever you want. To me, I just know I've seen people, when they have no oversight, they abuse it. That's the way people.
So as I say, I'm not suggesting that there be no balancing of these considerations. There should be balancing of these considerations. What we're facing now, however, is a situation where what's being threatened by government is extremely proscriptive, as I mentioned earlier, something which would impose totally unacceptable obligations upon our schools and our community. And I think that we have to be very vigilant to protect the independence of our schools. Now, at the same time, I think it's a healthy thing, frankly, that we're having a discussion about the quality of secular education in our schools. I think that that's something that ought to spur us internally to focus on this question. And in fact, under the banner of Pearls, I know that that very question has been taken up and is being taken up by educators who are developing curriculum to improve Limudei Chol in certain institutions. And I know that there's been conversation also about the high school curriculum that the so-called mainstream yeshivas are teaching, whether that can be tweaked a little bit to make it more relevant and to make it something which is treated more seriously in some of the schools. These are important internal conversations that are happening, and for all I know, you know, they may be, the fact that these conversations are taking place may be attributable to the general concern that has been raised about governmental oversight and the specter of government coming down very prescriptively on what schools have to teach. So, you know, that may be a byproduct.
A silver lining.
That may be a byproduct here. Yes.
Rabbi Zwiebel, let me further this conversation, and I understand it's beyond the rubric of the original conversation. But if you would go to government websites, they would say that the cost of raising a child or living in the United States today is around $15,000 a year per person to live on a somewhat moderate level. Now, our average family, and I'm not even sure this is fair, it depends which community you go to, but let's say it's six children and two parents. That would be eight people. That would be $120,000 a year for a family. That's not counting, this is American average. Clearly, we pay for education. If you have six kids in school, it's going to be minimum of $30,000 a year on top of the $120,000. Kosher food is more, everything, kosher clothing, everything, the neighborhoods we live in. But if you even take their minimal standard, which is $120,000, post-taxes, that means you need $200,000 to live just barely above the poverty level. And if that counting sending daughters to seminary, holding our children in jail, how are we as a community, and I get this question all the time from very confused young people, it's the top, you know, 3 or 4% of the American population that earns $200,000. How do we as a community say, in mass, all, can I know, river revavis of us, however they are, we all have to be in that 2 or 3%. It's just not something that's realistic, especially with our attitudes towards education. So opposite Ein Simchan al Hanes, what if somebody who is a leader, and you're clearly erudite, wise, advocate for our community, what would we tell all these young people?
Well, as you say, this is the subject of a much lengthier discussion, and it's a very difficult subject, obviously. But let me take this opportunity, given the discussion that we had earlier, to focus on those who have immersed themselves in intensive Torah study and go on beyond high school through Beis Medrash and beyond Beis Medrash through years and years of Kollel learning and so on, focusing pretty much exclusively on learning, and living a lifestyle that in the eyes of the world would be seen as in terms of economics, economically at least, on the lower end of the totem pole, living a very modest and humble lifestyle which some may say is a lifestyle of poverty, and doing so with simcha and with idealism and with a sense that they are, that they are fulfilling their mission on this earth. And the incredible thing is that there are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of such families in our midst, who in fact are the misalta al mishamna of Kali Yisrael. These are the people in whom we should take such enormous pride, despite the fact that, as you said, they're living way below the line of what would be considered in general society the bare minimum, so to say, in order to they sacrifice because of their ideals. And these are the people to whom we have to, I think, look up and be proud of. We ought not say that because of the need to make sure that our families are well fed and so on and so forth, that those families who choose a life of poverty because they're so deeply immersed in Torah study and Torah living, that somehow that they're wrong, they've made bad decisions in their lives. On the contrary, I think that we have to look to these people as our greatest and most wonderful treasures.
We agree with that. I'm talking about, but take the, I would certainly say the roiv who actually do go to work. Let's talk about the working person.
Okay.
Earning less than $200,000 puts us at the poverty line. How do we societally, as a leader, in front of a crowd and say, if your child does not earn less than $200, he will be. It's a frightening.
Yes.
It's a frightening couple. You know, with given our, and it's really more than that, because we have to add on education. which is
sure,
unfortunately not tax deductible. We have to add
We're working on it.
Yes, wonderfully. Yeah, it's with the new Betsy DeVoe. I saw you in the pictures with this meeting with her. With add on to that, you know, seminary, kids in. How do we?
Sure.
Society, when you get up in front of a crowd and say, every one of you will have to earn close to $300,000 to make ends meet, how do we say that? It's just frightening.
Okay, so I'll just offer it's a much longer conversation, and I'm not necessarily the best equipped, but there certainly are people asking these questions and coming up with at least incremental responses. Setting up training programs for our younger life to make sure that when they're ready to enter into the work world, that they'll be properly trained, and will be able to earn decent salaries and hopefully climb their way up through different professions and do well. We teach them business skills. We teach the wonderful programs like the Mesila program, which teach children and which teach families how to live more. More easily within their means, and not spend the kind of money that they really don't have. These kinds of training programs, Parnassa initiatives, and so on and so forth, I think are a hallmark of a community that is very attuned to the question that you ask, and I think that they have the support of the Gedolei Yisrael. I'm thinking of, for example, in Lakewood, the PCS program, which is a division of Agudas Yisrael, Professional Career Services, has enabled younger life to learn for years after the Kail, and years of Kail rather, and then when they leave, to be trained in a profession and earn a very nice salary. And I think it's a wonderful program. The larger question of if you look at the grand picture and say, is this sustainable for future generations, and how long can this continue to go? There is no definitive answer to that question. Part of the answer is bitachon, and part of the answer is, we have to binushnos dor vador. We have to consider how every generation changes, and we have to look at what may be appropriate for this generation may not have been appropriate for a previous generation. It could be that the Gedolei Yisrael will look at certain issues have attitudes about them and give directions about them that may be different than in previous generations. All of these things are impossible to predict with any degree of certainty, but when we speak about the overall conversation that we've been having today of how does this impact how our yeshivas teach their students and what the purpose of yeshiva education is and the importance of maintaining independence, at least to the point where the type of education, the number of hours that we educate our children is something that we determine and not some outside governmental force. I think that we have an obligation to continue to produce generations of Talmidei Chachamim, and that's never going to change. And that means that we're going to invest our resources and our energies still into building and improving upon the yeshiva system as it exists here in the United States and in Eretz Yisrael and really in many places of the world. Ultimately, l'shem l'tiferes.
Yeah, I would just like to share with you a verse. Just in Parshas Mishpatim, it says "Loisisa Hashem Hashav." Rashi says it means say a lie, right? Or don't use Hashem's name in vain, which is.
Mm-hmm.
But so Rashi says brings two pshatim. He says what's the example of a lie? Rashi says if somebody's makabel edus, one without one baldin without the other baldin.
Mm-hmm.
You're hearing one side of the story, and the right. That's the first pshat in Rashi, and the other pshat in Rashi is not to speak lashon hara. Speak lashon hara zayva lo sisa she, which is astonishing. Because lashon hara is only the truth. If it's emes, it's maitzi shemra. If it's
right. So
what's the point Rashi's telling us? How could lashon hara be? Why is lashon hara a lie if it's the truth? Because we pick one facet and we focus on that, and we just focus on one facet. Rashi says that's a lie. So Lashon Hara is a lie because you're blowing one facet out of proportion. In other words, looking at life with perspective and not with a singularity, but looking at the entire picture, perspective, balance, maturity, that is emes, and blowing a particular part out of proportion is what's a sheker. And I think that as our public advocate, taking this legislation and saying, how do we do it so that it's proportionate, where we're giving our children the education that they need, on the other hand, excluding anything that goes neged our emuna, our beten, against what we were makabel from our zedis, from our elta zedis, by our Sinai, getting that in perfect perspective is really...
I would just add to that, it's not just those things that are neged the emuna, but, is it really important to sacrifice a daf of Gemara and Bava Kamma to learn about the Ming dynasty or to learn about Sokotoa or whatever it is that we spent our time?
Or Isosceles triangle.
There you go. So in other words, there are certain things which may not be against our Masorah, but in terms of the overall picture, who says that that's what makes a well-educated? And certainly,
we agree. But it's so legislating that balance, but
right.
The kids come out knowing what 10 times 10 is, wherever they do, how to balance a checkbook. I think that balance is what we need a great public advocate like you, I should say a public advocate, a frum advocate like you, erudite-wise advocate like you to accomplish.
Well, now that you've flattered me so, I guess I need to start doing that.
Thank you very much.
David, thank you. Thank you for inviting me on the program. And I wish you only tremendous continued bracha v'atzlacha, not only in your in this, which I'll call Avodas HaKodesh, your radio program, which brings so much important information to the community from a halachic perspective, but also more generally, you're one of the great Balei Tzedakah of our time, and Ashrechem for all that you do.
Thank you so much, Rav Zwiebel.
Somebody showed us this week an interesting app called the Tahor app, T-A-H-O-R-A-P-P, that you can get online, and basically you take a picture of a Shaila, of a Mara, and a tshuva comes back, an answer comes back. No more Rabbanim, we're going to put Rabbanim out of business. So we asked one of the great Paiskim of our generation, somebody who Rav Moshe Feinstein called Yedidi, one of the unique people in the world, Rav Yehuda David Bleich, his opinion about the Torah.
We have the honor of having with us on the phone Hagoyin Rav Yehuda David Bleich, who's the Mara D'Asra of Kehillas B'nei Yehuda. He's also Rosh Yeshiva by Yeshivas Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan. He's a Musmach by the Rashke Bahagra Moshe Feinstein, and he's one of the few people in the world who could say that Rav Moshe referred to them as Yedidi. It's an honor to have you with us, Rabbi Bleich.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
A number of Rabbanim have come up with an app. It's called Boho Rap, and it's been in the papers a lot lately, where an Isha could take a picture of a Mara on her iPhone or on her Android device or whatever other device she has. And I guess in good light, they ask you to do it under white light, good light. They send it to these Rabbanim, and they get a psak back based on the picture of the color and the picture of the Mara. As somebody who is clearly the author of many B'nesivos Halacha, contemporary, dozens Svarim, what would be your opinion of such an app?
Let me answer by saying first that many years ago, I was approached by highly responsible people, and they asked me to prepare a kind of a color chart for Maris of Dam, so that Talmidim, others who wanted to become proficient in Maris, would be able to use the charts, and Rabbonim, who didn't have Shimush in Maris, would be able to take the Mara and compare it to the chart, and they'll know whether it's a Kesem or it's not a Kesem. And my response was skepticism. My skepticism was based upon the fact that I have had the experience of having my apartment painted. And I know that if you go to the paint store, they will show you a color chart, and you choose a color, and they mix the paint accordingly. In my very limited and unscientific experience, the paint never looked like the color on the chart. And nobody was trying to fool me. It meant simply that for whatever reason, these color charts weren't terribly reliable. That's point number one. Point number two, there's now something called Color Xerox. I've used Color Xerox, and not because I was interested in a color of any kind particularly, but every time that I've used a Color Xerox and compared it with the original, it's not the same. It's a reasonable approximation thereof, but it's not really the same. I question seriously, without having seen this app, I don't know how to use a computer, so the app's not going to help me very much. I thought that we have a prejudice against computers. Now suddenly people are telling me to use computers with apps. But okay, we'll let that point slide. I suspect that the app can't be any more reliable than something like the paint color chart or the Xerox machine. And that's the first point. The second point is that anybody who's ever looked at a Mara knows that you look at a Mara either against your skin, you wrap it tightly around the finger, or you use a white surface underneath in order to be able to tell the shade with some degree of certainty. You also turn it upside down, inside out. You kind of spread the woof and the warp in order to see what the Mara really looks like. I don't really know how you can do things like that if you're using an artificial device in the form of an app. Obviously, you're going to tell the difference between what I call a Mara Lovan. It's not a Shiloh in the first place, and something that's red. Obviously, the app can do that. I don't need an app for that. It's easy enough. Or maybe you do need an app. Maybe you can use the app as a screening device, so that the Rov can say, look, this isn't a Shiloh altogether, forget about it. Or to say, look, I can't paskin on the basis of the app, but yeah, this is a Shiloh, bring it to me and I'll look at it. I don't know how you could say anything definitively on the basis of color comparison by using some artificial device of that nature. That doesn't mean that it's an impossibility. It seems to me, though, that it's probably not reliable. And it's not reliable for empirical reasons, that when you really had the sticky problems, the ones that are dependent upon the shikla das of the person who's seeing the mara. He's got to see something clearly so that he knows how to compare it with things that he's seen in the past and knows whether it is neitel edaim, is it reddish, pinkish, or isn't it? And that's very hard to tell the difference between some shades of red and some shades of brown. I really am skeptical about whether an app will help in any of those problems. Of course, it'll tell you the difference between something which is absolutely red and something which is not at all approaching red. But that, for that, it shouldn't be necessary to have the app in the first place.
So you're saying if it's, maybe if he has an amoritz who Pashit knows nothing, so to eliminate the extremely stylus, it would be possible, but anything that needs any shilas chacham would be impossible.
That, I believe, is correct. And I would hesitate to use it for anything simply because I understand there are people out there who are relying on it for just about everything. But, yes, I mean, I've had people who have sent me Maris Federal Express. I know that's satircha. It's an expense, not to speak of delay for other matters that one would like to eliminate. But after a while, the people who send these maris can tell the difference between what's a shaila and what isn't a shaila altogether. If you were to use the app to teach the women, not the Mary Heroa, use the app to teach the women what is a shaila and what isn't a shaila, perhaps. Again, if it hadn't come into vogue as a kind of a substitute for a Mary Heroa, it would have been a lot easier to convince me that there's value in it. And I'm not saying that there's no value. Of course there's a value in it, but it's got to be used with a great deal of caution, a great deal of discretion. I think you can only use it to distinguish between what I call a Mara Lovon and something which is a Shaila. But once it's a Shaila, I don't see how you can really make a determination without seeing the Mara itself.
It's been a very big honor to have you with us, and we thank you very much for your most valuable time. Thank you very much, Rabbi Bloch.
Thank you, Kol Tov.
I want to thank you all for listening, and I want to remind you all, if you haven't gotten, go get the best Halacha Sefer in English printed this year, Headlines 2. I'm sure you're going to enjoy it. This is David Lichtenstein for Headlines Radio.